Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. Today we'll talk about politics and what it means for you and the country. Several cities have succeeded in increasing the minimum wage. Will recent successes snowball into a national movement? Congressman Henry Waxman of Los Angeles is retiring after 40 years in office. What's happening in the race to replace him in one of the hottest contests in one of the most fascinating districts in America? The majority leader in the U.S. House, Republican Eric Cantor, recently lost his primary in an upset that shocked everybody. What happened, and will this change make things better or worse? Hillary Clinton seems poised to be the next president of the United States. But we heard that in 2008, and yet she lost to upstart Barack Obama. Will a similar surprise happen this time? Here with us to discuss all this and more is Harold Meyerson, one of the country's leading political analysts. Harold Meyerson is editor-at-large of the American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country, where he has worked for 12 years. He also writes a weekly op-ed column for the Washington Post, where he's been a columnist for 10 years. From 1989 through 2001, he was executive editor of the LA Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. His articles on politics, labor, the economy, foreign policy, and American culture have also appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, and The Nation. His op-eds, commentary, and book reviews have been published in the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, as well as numerous other publications. Harold Meyerson, welcome back to All Together Now.
Always good to be here, Eleanor.
Yeah, it's a joy. You know, there's been so much that happened since we spoke last fall. And one of the most interesting things to me now is, and hopeful, is this whole movement for the minimum wage. So we now have, what, the national minimum wage at $7.25 an hour, which is barely $15,000 a year. And so it seems like that's, in a way, become the focus that came out of the concern with income inequality that the Occupy movement arose to address. So where are we at with the minimum wage? Where has it been increased, and is there any chance that that increase will become national?
Well, one of the more interesting developments since we spoke last is the election not just of Bill de Blasio as mayor of New York, which has received tremendous publicity, and rightly so, but of a whole series of progressive mayors and councils across the country. And a lot of them have taken action to raise minimum wages, living wages, to enact paid sick days. And some of this has gone on in the most blue, the most democratic of states as well. I would say this is addressing two phenomena, both of which are subsets of the issue of pervasive and growing economic inequality. One is the inability of Washington to do anything, since Republicans will not vote for anything that is remotely related to the current president of the United States. And two is the general collapse of unions in the private sector. Time was in the mid-1950s when over one-third of American workers in the private sector, probably close to 40%, of American workers were unionized, and that kind of made routine every few years, if they had a decent union, the raising of workers' wages. But since unionization has shrunk down to less than 7% now in the private sector, incomes and workers' wages haven't budged. And there isn't a lot that's sort of obvious that governments can do about this except raise the minimum wage. And so where you see progressives in control of government, which is increasingly the case in cities, at the moment of the 30 largest American cities, 26 have Democratic mayors, by no means all of them notably progressive, but more and more of them inclined to raise the minimum wage. Even a fairly establishment, not notably progressive mayor like Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, he appointed a commission about what the minimum wage there should be, and they came back with a report earlier this week that said in a couple of years it should go up to $15. So that's a real possibility, even with a centrist Democratic mayor. So essentially, we're seeing this wherever, you know, this is the water flowing downhill. There's tremendous pressure now to boost workers' incomes, and this is really the only open channel there is.
That's fascinating. So you mentioned about Rahm Emanuel's commission saying we'll go up to $15 a year. Wasn't that passed in Seattle? Didn't Seattle say already that we're going to go up to $15
It was, right? Indeed. Yes, it was indeed. And that's kind of a fascinating tale. As you know, the fast food workers have had a movement to raise their wage to $15 an hour, and it's backed up by the Service Employees International Union. When the fast food workers began demonstrating in Seattle, the leader of the largest and most influential SEIU local there, David Rolfe, saw that this was coinciding with the early stages of the race for mayor in Seattle, which had a mayoral election last year, just like many cities, and sought to inject the issue into the mayor's race. And his one, I don't know what to call it, coup de theatre, coup de politics, whatever, was that during one of the televised debates with all the mayoral candidates, he was able to get a fast food worker, he got the TV station to say, okay, we'll let a fast food worker ask some questions. So, of course, the fast food worker said, well, what would you think about raising the minimum wage here to $15 an hour? And either because they believed it or because they were caught flat-footed or because they didn't want to look bad in front of a progressive TV audience, all of the candidates said, sure. Rolfe and his union backed the candidate who eventually won, Ed Murray, and he set up a business labor task force to sort of figure out the whens and the hows and the wherefores of doing this, and it included, most notably, on the business side, the head of the local hotel association, local restaurant association, which are historically, particularly the restaurants, the two major opponents of raising the minimum wage. And at the end of this protracted process, they all said, okay, we'll go to $15 over this, you know, it's a complicated phase-in period. But it's really a remarkable victory for workers and certainly speaks well of the city of Seattle.
That's pretty amazing. Now, when you're talking about the restaurant workers in the hotel or the restaurant association and the hotel association, you're talking about the owners in that case, not the unions that we're used to hearing supporting this progressive legislation. But this is the companies supported the rise in minimum wage?
The associations did, yes, and these are associations of the owners and operators. That's right. That's not to say there isn't still some business opposition in Seattle. They've taken this to court, but I really don't see unless the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the minimum wage in the 1930s, and I really don't see that they have much of a legal leg to stand on. But yeah, well, it's a statement of, among other things, the relative affluence of Seattle, and it's the relative progressivity of Seattle, that they got a substantial share of business to come along with this.
Right. Well, and also kind of enlightened self-interest also, isn't it? I mean, isn't it shown that if people are earning better wages and have better working conditions, you have a stable workforce and you lose less money in staff turnover and staff training, right?
Absolutely. You also have a lot more people with discretionary income that they're going to spend more. I mean, right now, one of the major problems in the United States is with wages depressed and with property values and rents in most major cities anyway, still quite high. Once these folks are done paying the monthly rent, there isn't a hell of a lot left over. And so this, and studies in Los Angeles have shown this, this would really increase the spending power and, be a boost to the local economy. So it's But the scope of this is really remarkable. I mean, in the last couple of years, California has raised the minimum wage up to $10 an hour in stages. It went to $9 on July 1st. San Francisco is going to have a ballot measure to raise the wage there to $15. The three cities in the East Bay of Oakland and two others are Berkeley looking at jointly raising the wage. It's even going to be in the ballot in San Diego, which is no one's idea of a hard left city. So that's the case in California, but you know, here in Washington, where we are, Eleanor, the city of D.C. raised the wage in conjunction with the two adjoining counties in Maryland. This is really, you know, a coming thing, and it's again, if Democrats broadly and progressives and others, people of goodwill, are looking at how to address economic inequality, this is kind of your obvious step one. After this, it gets harder, given that there are hardly any unions, and we sort of have gone on the assumption that workers gain something from productivity increases, but of course they haven't since the mid-1970s. So anything else would require, anything beyond this, which we badly need, requires, I think, you know, structural changes to how the economy works. This requires, you know, passing an ordinance, and that's easier to do. It's necessary. And for the foreseeable future, so long as the Republicans have a majority in the House and can block anything requiring 60 votes in the Senate, it's not going to happen at the national level.
Yeah, which is so amazing, isn't it, when you just take as a given that anything that's going to be helping the working man and the working woman here, like raising the minimum wage, has no prayer of passing in Congress. But, you know, where they can mobilize is to bail out Wall Street to the tune of billions and even trillions of dollars. So, you know, it's just scary the state we're at, that we take that as a given, that Congress isn't going to really take action to help the working people.
Yep.
But it is great that the mobilization is happening at the municipal level there, and on occasion, like you mentioned, California at the state level. Because that's a real serious bump up for people. If you're going from $7.25 an hour, which you're only making $15,000 a year, you move that up to $15 an hour, you're talking over $30,000 a year. That's a real difference in your quality of life.
Oh, absolutely. It's transformative. I mean, $15 an hour, is, as you said, is $30,000 a year, which is not, you know, it is not a princely income. If you have a two-household family, though, where both adults, let's say, are working and get that, then you're up to, you know, a modestly livable income, and that would be huge in this country.
And do all the cities have the right to raise the minimum wage? Wasn't it California, when California raised the minimum wage to $10 an hour, they also said there's something about the right for cities to raise it higher if they wanted?
Yes, the cities, that depends. That goes state by state, and it's been interesting to see. As I said, most cities are, due to the demographic changes in the United States, increasingly under Democratic control. And even when they're not, most cities, the remaining major cities out that aren't, you know, completely white conservative, have moderate Republican mayors. Now, Oklahoma City, which is no one's idea of, Petrograd during the Bolshevik takeover, Oklahoma City was going to put a measure on the ballot to raise the wage in Oklahoma City, but the Republican legislature and governor passed a bill that said cities don't have this right. So it varies from state to state. Now, one of the most interesting developments in politics in the last couple of months is New York. There, Andrew Cuomo, the ostensibly Democratic governor, was actually opposed to having cities raise the wage on their own, even though, as anyone who's ever been in New York will tell you, the cost of living in New York City greatly exceeds the cost of living upstate by a factor of a lot. And this was one of the key points that Bill de Blasio ran on and was elected mayor. Anyway, there was a very complicated political dance in New York over whether the Working Families Party, which is a left-wing party which nonetheless, due to the peculiarities of New York election law, can and does endorse Democrats, in which they more or less withheld an endorsement for Cuomo's reelection campaign unless he met a few demands. One of the keys was reversing his position on the minimum wage. So it's highly likely that when he's reelected and the legislature convenes next year, the legislature will allow cities to raise the minimum wage 30% higher than the state level, which would basically mean that in New York, the minimum wage could be raised up to a little over $13 an hour as opposed to its current $9. So that's a big difference.
Wonderful. It's exciting to see that kind of progress happening across the country. And we talked about the California state legislature once again leading the way for the nation here in raising the minimum wage in the entire state. But let's talk a little bit more about California, specifically Los Angeles. I was recently in Los Angeles for that primary to replace Henry Waxman, the House member who announced unexpectedly that he's retiring at the end of his term this year. That is one wild race for the open seat. There were 18 candidates running. It was an amazing race, and I know you come from that area. You know more about that area politically than probably almost anybody alive. So what's your sense of what's happening in that race for the open seat that Waxman now holds in the L.A. area?
Well, first of all, a little history. This is a district that historically has been centered on West Los Angeles. Like the west side of Manhattan, affluent, heavily Jewish, heavily liberal. And liberal not only on bread and butter issues, but very out front on environmental issues, some political process issues, everything that Henry Waxman embodied. Well, you know, to Waxman's great credit, a lot of his great achievements center on expanding Medicaid and medical care generally around the not just the Obamacare bill, which he helped shepherd through the House, but expansions of Medicaid. Even when Ronald Reagan was president, he was able to maneuver this stuff through the House. And as events would have it, his district has always had, you know, a very low rate of uninsured people. So Waxman's concerns, very much to the benefit of the nation, extended well beyond the immediate material needs of his district, which honestly weren't that much as by American standards. And another thing about that district is it was, for a time, the center of a political machine isn't quite the word. Waxman had an alliance with his fellow L.A. Congressman Howard Berman that you know, helped elect Democrats and progressives around the state, but that kind of lapsed some time ago. One of the other things about that district just struck me as fascinating. I think it is the center of the anti-smoking movement.
Is that where it came from?
Anti-smoking, yes. The first, Waxman is famous for that hearing where he had the seven CEOs of tobacco companies call before him and asked if, you know, they let their kids smoke and things like that. So Waxman was pushing this stuff at the national level, but the state laws against smoking in public were passed by authored by state legislators whose districts were encompassed by Waxman's district, and the city ordinance against smoking in public was authored by the city councilman. This is decades ago. Whose district also was encompassed by Waxman's district. And these were the first such ordinances there were. So really, the anti-smoking movement really has its historic roots in West Los Angeles. Make of that what you will. Anyway, that is not the key issue there now. It's not easy to say what the key issue there now is. And the district was somewhat recarved in the last redistricting after the 2010 census to include a lot of the somewhat less liberal but still on the whole Democratic area that, as you proceed south from West L.A. along the Pacific, the area that in Los Angeles is called South Bay. So you're right. There was, you know, this was a this district was considered a plum, and Waxman was always able to raise funds out of this district that he was able to use to bolster liberals and Democrats around the country. I mean, the district includes Beverly Hills, Bel Air, so you get the picture.
Yeah, this is we're talking here now about the second wealthiest district in America. This is, you know, we got Beverly Hills, as you mentioned, and a lot of wealthy people living there.
Beverly Hills, Bel Air, Brentwood, Pacific Palisades. When I was growing up in that area, it wasn't nearly as wealthy as it is now. It's still very well off, but right now it's just, you know, I think they may not smoke, but it's still a filthy rich district. So that part of it, anyway. It also includes some less affluent parts of West LA, the South Bay, and the San Fernando Valley. But on the whole, it's a pretty well-heeled district. So you're right. There were innumerable candidates running. California has a process called the jungle primary, which I think is a not a great idea, in which the two people who run 1-2 in a primary are the ones who advance to the runoff, regardless of party. So there was a slew of Democrats running and rather few Republicans. So there was one top vote getter who was a Republican because she didn't have much competition. And the Democrats duked it out. And the guy who won was the state senator from the area of the so-called South Bay, a guy named Ted Lieu, who I think is pretty likely going to be the winner of that contest and will succeed Henry Waxman.
So let's talk about that a bit, because I know this idea of the jungle primary where you could get the, you know, have it open, anybody can run, and you could end up with whoever the top two vote-getters would be would advance to the final, so you could conceivably have two Democrats running in the final. But when you actually look at the results in California, both in this district and kind of across the state, it pretty much still comes down to the Democratic-endorsed candidate, in this case Ted Lieu, and the Republican-endorsed candidate, in this case Alan Carr, tend to be the ones who win to go on to the final, don't they?
Yeah, but the jungle primary, I actually wrote an op-ed about this in the L.A. Times. The jungle primary allows for peculiar accidents, and the most common accident is this. You have a Democratic district, and California is an overwhelmingly Democratic state. The registration figures have the percentage of registered voters in California who registered Democratic is in the mid-40s. The percentage of voters in California registered Republican has dropped beneath 30%. It's now about 27-28%. So major disparity. That means in a lot of districts, if there's an open seat and a tight race, just by the you know, the fact that Democrats are in the majority, more Democrats will run than Republicans. And this has led in at least one instance to a heavily Democratic district having its runoff in the last election in 2012 between two Republicans for a House seat somewhat east of Los Angeles in the Redlands area. So this is a totally anomalous, peculiar situation that's a result of the Democratic primary, the result of the jungle primary. And now the problem with this is this could happen even on a statewide level. There was a race for state controller on the ballot in June, this June, and it turns out it'll be a Democrat against a Republican, not surprisingly, and the Democrat should win. But on election night, it had two Republicans leading for a statewide office, even though Californians haven't elected a Republican to a statewide office in forever, with the exception of Arnold Schwarzenegger, which was during a recall, which was very weird circumstances. Now, fast forward to 2018, when Jerry Brown, who will presumably be reelected by a huge margin this year, will be term limited out as governor. You could have a gubernatorial primary round one in California that would have, let's say, the lieutenant governor, Gavin Newsom, the state attorney general, Kamala Harris, former L.A. mayor, Antonio Villaraigosa, and a bunch of minor Democrats running, and let's say you only had two Republicans, say the mayor of Fresno, the mayor of San Diego, it is possible, if there are enough Democrats in the field, that the Republicans, the Democrats would split the vote, and Republicans would finish 1-2, even though, you know, they would get only, let's say, 40% of the total vote cast in the jungle primary, whereas the Democratic candidates would get close to 60. You know, so it is a crazy process, and I think the technical political science term I would apply to it is dumb.
So do you think
it's a ticking time bomb? I mean, it could really result in it could really lead to a result that subjects the state to wildly unrepresentative candidates in a runoff, and there's no possibility for write-ins or anything like that in round two of a jungle primary. You're stuck with whoever finishes 1-2.
So do you think that
it also eliminates, you know, it also eliminates minor parties from a, you know, November ballot. I mean, you know, there is no such thing.
Right.
You only have two.
So are you in favor of repealing the jungle primary, or do you think it should
Absolutely.
Be reformed? Okay.
No. I mean, the only way to reform it is to go back to parties. And, you know, that would also allow a November election in which you could have people representing third parties and fourth parties and themselves if they qualify for the ballot.
Excellent. Well, believe it or not, we're almost ready for a break. But before I do, I just want to ask you one quick question. And that is, you mentioned that you think State Senator Ted Lieu, who came in number two in this primary, is the likely winner. But wasn't it true in the last election with this redistricting that Henry Waxman just came in with, you know, he kind of squeaked by a little bit there with what was like maybe 54% of the vote, and Ted Lieu is certainly not as well known and doesn't have the deep pockets that Waxman did. So don't you think the Republican, Alan Carr, could knock him out?
I think that's remote. I think the Democrats will focus on this race this year. They didn't really focus on the race a couple of years ago. And you know, Waxman was blindsided. He ran against a candidate who was a longtime Republican who listed himself nonetheless as you know, an independent, and who was independently wealthy and had a lot of money. So I would think Ted Lieu will still win. I should also mention that guy who ran against Waxman 2 years ago was an old high school classmate of mine.
Oh, my God.
And I didn't have a big high school class. It was only like 180 kids. And he kind of went through high school without anyone noticing him, but he ended up with a lot of money, and you're right, got 46% of the vote running for Congress.
Well, you know, if you spend whatever, $7 million can bring you a lot of votes.
Indeed.
All right, we're going to pause now for a break. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Harold Meyerson, on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large of the American Prospect and columnist for the Washington Post. Before the break, we were talking about the election for the House seat in Los Angeles. And, Harold, you were saying you think that State Senator Ted Lieu will win, and certainly has a leg up there, where I think it's 80% of the district is in his current state Senate district, so he certainly has a good shot at it. And how do you think Ted Lieu would be as a member of Congress?
Well, he's your basic center-left, not too left, but center-left Democrat, and I think he would, pretty much fit the bill. I'm not quite sure what issues he's carved out in his service in the legislature, except the bill which became law, which was prohibiting gay conversion therapy, a kind of ridiculous scam perpetrated on usually gay young people, though I suppose it could be perpetrated on gay and lesbian people of any age, that with the right therapy, they can become straight. He did author that, which and steered it to enactment, which I thought was a fairly notable achievement. But look, no one's replacing Henry Waxman. Henry Waxman was the great liberal legislator in the House of the last four decades, much as Ted Kennedy was in the Senate. And whoever replaces Waxman, well, first of all, I mean, and let's also keep in mind that so long as the Republicans control the House, Henry Waxman couldn't be Henry Waxman, which is probably one reason why he left. There's not much even a legislative genius like Waxman can do when the Republicans simply don't, you know, aren't willing to listen to any ideas originating from a Democrat.
Right, and that's going to be true certainly for the next 2 years while Obama finishes out his term. And along those lines, in a stunning turn of events, the majority leader in the House, Republican Eric Cantor, recently lost his primary in an upset that would just amaze and stun the political world. You know, what do you think happened? Why do you think Eric Cantor lost?
Well, first of all, he clearly didn't see it coming. And, you know, there's been some criticism about the media for not seeing it coming. But if the candidate himself has no apprehension that he's in danger, I think it's a bit much to expect the media to give much coverage to the race. And, you know, one thing this should do, I mean, he got a poll from a private poll from a Republican pollster that showed him leading by 30-some percent a few days before the election. So I think it should cause some pollsters to go out of business. That's one consequence. Clearly, he was out of touch with the Tea Party elements in his own district. At one large level, that's fairly ironic, since he was clearly to John Boehner's right and the person who was trying to integrate the Tea Party into the House Republican caucus, which he was more or less in charge of, in a relatively frictionless way, which proved to be all but impossible. But also, he was identified quite rightly as the Republican in the House was probably closest to Wall Street. And say what you will about the Tea Party, that is not their inclination. They, like populists of old, tend not to be fans of big banks, although if Obama were to attack big banks, they would, I think, as just a classic knee-jerk reaction, defend them. But if the attack comes from somewhere else, I think they'd be fairly happy with it. So Cantor was viewed as rightly, as I said, as an agent of Wall Street. That did not endear him. And I think this was a factor in his defeat. And it also speaks to just the increasing intransigence of much of the Republican base. It's the one part of the, you know, I mean, even if the majority of the party at some level wants immigration reform, and I think polling shows that the majority does, people in places like rural and some parts of white suburban Virginia may not be so inclined. And the polling shows that the Tea Party is the one element in American politics that isn't so inclined. They have an embattled sense, I think, of losing you know, white folks' America, and I think that is a major factor in everything they do, and turns out to have been a factor in Cantor's defeat.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I was concerned that the initial response when Eric Cantor lost was to say, well, he lost it because of his stance on immigration, and therefore any chance of an immigration bill in this current session is out the window. But I think your analysis is much more accurate, which is that Cantor was way too close to Wall Street, and the Tea Party Republicans and other Republicans, not just the Tea Party, don't want someone so close to Wall Street.
Right. One might add that much of the hesitation in the Democratic Party about Hillary Clinton is over the very same issue. So, you know, this is... this is a pervasive issue at many points in the political spectrum.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to talk about Hillary in a minute, but before we get there, just thinking about whoever wins this seat in L.A. and goes into Congress is going to be joining a Congress that seems unable or unwilling to pass even the most basic legislation. I mean, I'm horrified to be watching now this discussion about a bill for transportation to fix our roads and bridges. Just seems too hard for Congress to get it together and to pass. And is the problem what Senator Majority Leader Harry Reid said yesterday, that the Republican strategy is to block all bills to make Obama look bad? Or what's happening with that transportation bill, and do you think it would pass?
I think the short answer to the Harry Reid question is yes. Harry Reid, I think, is right. And in general, I mean, as soon as Obama got elected, Mitch McConnell, the first time, Mitch McConnell said, well, our main mission is to make sure he doesn't get reelected. So voting no on anything that he or the Democrats propose, or in the case of the House, refusing to bring anything up, explains a lot of what's going on. Now, highway bill is a little different because most building contractors and road contractors are historic and current supporters of Republican Party, and most mayors, regardless of party, really want their roads paved, things like that. And so it's so close to home and so not traditionally an ideological issue.
Right.
That I think some accommodation will be reached in the House. Apparently, you know, the Republican stumbling block is, you know, they don't want to raise a gas tax, they don't want to raise any tax. But there seems to be a move to reclassify some pension funds, and I do not understand the details of this, nor do I profess to reclassify some pension funds that would therefore free up some money for a relatively short period of time that would enable them to raise enough revenue to refund the highway program. That's what I think the latest developments are. But, you know, I mean, basically anything that would have been fairly straightforward in an earlier period of the last 50, 60 years or 70 years has now requires, like in billiard parlance, a four-cushion shot just to, you know, knock one ball with another. So everything is tortuous.
It really is, and this is the Congress that actually has passed less legislation than the do-nothing Congress. So, you know, we're talking historic lows in terms of productivity with the folks that are in there now. But what amazes me is that instead of people kind of seeing that and getting mad, which of course they are, but instead of then voting to get some, you know, fresh blood, some people who will take that on and change it, it looks like, you know, people are declining to vote and staying away. I mean, even the recent primary out there, we talked about L.A. and California, but the turnout is abysmal. But, you know, why aren't people getting out there to vote to get new people in instead of turning away?
Well, to a certain degree, I mean, the brilliance, if that's the word, of the Republican strategy is that it costs. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They've ensured the government can't really do much, and if government can't really do much, why would you vote? So, in a certain sense, at least going back as far as Barry Goldwater, the central strategy of Republicans has been to delegitimate government, and they're doing a bang-up job of that by simply keeping government from doing even the basics. So I think that's one reason. A second reason, I mean, you want to break this down by group participation. A second reason is that the economy is structurally so screwed up that Obama can't deliver the kind of reasonable prosperity that Democratic presidents in the past have been able to deliver. The way in which wealth no longer trickles down at all in America, the way in which income is frozen, requires a real restructuring, I think, at this juncture, of some of the basic economic norms and rules and laws in this country. Politically, that's off the table right now. And even though there is what passes for a recovery in this country, many people are really hurting economically, and among them are our core Democratic constituencies, particularly the young. I mean, the Democratic Party is going to retain the loyalty of African Americans, of largely of Latinos, of the young, but voter turnout is really going to fall, and that is the problem for both voter participation and the Democrats. Republicans, hardcore Republicans, will continue to vote out of sheer hatred, which is a strong motivator. But the incumbents need to deliver on the economy, and that's almost no longer possible. So even though the Democrats, broadly speaking, have a major demographic edge in the composition of the electorate, and that's only going to continue to grow, and it'll be reflected in higher turnout elections like those in presidential years, the inability to get the economy moving in a way that benefits more than just a handful of wealthy people is, I think, a real hindrance to boosting turnout.
That's kind of a scary prospect, but
it is.
So we talked briefly about Hillary, and I want to talk more about her now. In fact, your op-ed in today's Washington Post, which I loved, talks about the two sides of Hillary Clinton, one the pro-Wall Street, the other the pro-Main Street. And you argue that these have been the two sides of the Democratic Party, but that was covered over when the economy was doing better and prosperity was broadly shared. Now the economy is not doing so well, and as you note, the top 1% is taking 95% of the nation's growth and income. So is the fig leaf off for the Democrats? Will Democrats now in current elections need to declare whose side are they on, Wall Street or Main Street?
Well, I think to a degree they don't want that to happen, but it's going to happen. When John F. Kennedy famously said a rising tide lifts all boats, that was on the surface a fair description of the American economy back when John F. Kennedy was president, in the days when the economy was national and not open to the pressures of globalization, and in the days when a critical mass of workers belonged to unions. That's no longer the case. And I was struck by the fact that my piece was one of just three in the past 2 days that have dealt with aspects of this. William Galston, who was the one really brilliant guy back at the sort of centrist Democratic Leadership Council during days before and of Bill Clinton's presidency, has been writing some really interesting columns in the Wall Street Journal, where he's their resident non-Republican. And he's been writing about, Hillary has a real conundrum here. What is she going to propose to enable workers to make gains that reflect their increased productivity? So he wrote a column like that yesterday. And today, Noam Scheiber has a piece up at the New Republic website that's saying, oh, come on, Hillary, we're not all in this together. That's a line that she used. She said, you've got to acknowledge that Wall Street's interests and the rest of the Democratic base interest are counterposed, not one and the same. My column begins by just noting, Hillary's sort of close ties to Wall Street, which were certainly enhanced by the fact that she was a senator from New York, on the one hand. But she gave an interview this week to Der Spiegel, the German magazine, in which she said she basically agreed with the economic thesis of Thomas Piketty, that capital is gaining and labor isn't, and this leads to an inherent tendency towards upward redistribution of wealth. So which is it? And I put out a couple of my somewhat non-mainstream ideas about how you can increase labor income at the expense of capital income. But then I also made a modest suggestion, which is based on my reading of a very good book that came out 5 or 6 years ago by Adam Cohen called Nothing to Fear, which is a book about the first 100 days of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency. And it contains this wonderful little anecdote. Roosevelt is thinking over who he's going to make his Treasury Secretary. And, of course, you know, the Democrats have had a string now of Treasury Secretaries who come from places like Goldman Sachs, but or proteges of people who come from Goldman Sachs, be it Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, Tim Geithner, or Jacob Lew. But Roosevelt, however, was thinking about who he should make his Treasury Secretary, and he was thinking about a prominent senator, Carter Glass. But Carter Glass wanted to appoint a guy named Russell Leffingwell, who was head of the J.P. Morgan Bank at the time, as his deputy. And Roosevelt was talking to his chief aide at the time, Raymond Moley, and he said, no, we just can't have anyone from 23. Now, the 23 was the address of the Morgan Bank. It was 23 Wall Street. And I think that's a pretty good starting point for any Democratic aspirant for the presidency, that they not have people from Wall Street at a time when Wall Street's interests and the interests of the rest of the nation are counterposed rather than complementary. So no one from 23 or anywhere else on or of Wall Street.
Yeah, and I think you put your finger on perhaps the fatal flaw in Obama's administration right from the get-go when he was talking to and bringing into his administration the same old from Wall Street. You know, Tim Geithner and Larry Summers had been trotting around in those circles, and it just looked like right from the beginning he was just listening to Wall Street with no one who was a real strong advocate for Main Street in his inner circle.
On economic policy, I think that's sad but true. He himself probably had some more inclinations, but Geithner in particular, I mean, Summers actually has gotten better as time has gone on.
He got better when he left.
Yeah, but Geithner really put the salvation of the banks far ahead of anything to compel the banks actually to loan the trillions of dollars that we were giving them as taxpayers to loan them out and to do anything significant for underwater homeowners.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. I think Hillary is one of the most prepared people ever to be president. I mean, given her experience as First Lady and U.S. Senator and Secretary of State and kind of being at the top levels of political discussions in the country and the world for the past 30 years. And as a woman, I'm excited about a potential woman being president, but I am so concerned about her very close ties to Wall Street, and she may, throw out some crumbs for working people, but I think when push comes to shove, when it comes to the economy, she really represents and listens to and would act in favor of Wall Street, which I don't think we can afford to do anymore.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think it would, for progressives, I think it's important to start making the kind of demands on her that these three people, including myself, that I mentioned have made. And, if we don't get any puffs of white smoke out of the Hillary Vatican, we might want to encourage someone like Elizabeth Warren to throw her hat into the ring, to mix metaphors completely. White smoke, hats in the ring, whatever.
Right.
Anyway, I think that there really needs to be, a period of leaning on Hillary from the left on the on economic issues in particular. It's also the case, there was a good piece in the Sunday New York Times about how a number of some neoconservative foreign policy folks are also drifting in her direction too. So that's not the only Hillary warning flag, but anyway, all of these are things that I think progressives need to make themselves heard on in the next few weeks and months.
Totally agreed. And, you know, as someone in full disclosure, I worked on the Elizabeth Warren campaign, and I think she's fantastic. I think she is a great senator, and I think she'd make a great president. But in the current circumstance, I don't see her running. The polls are showing Hillary at 52% and Elizabeth Warren at 7% for the Democratic primary. But I do think that 52% for Hillary is soft, and Hillary has shown, even in recent weeks, an ability to step on her own story and suffer from self-inflicted wounds. And if Elizabeth Warren got out there and made the case, I mean, no one questions which side Elizabeth Warren is on. I think if she ran, I think Elizabeth Warren could beat Hillary in the Democratic primary.
We shall see. We shall see. I think that might be hard, but I think it might be might really pressure Hillary from the left, and that would be a good thing.
Right, exactly. So I wanted to ask you, Noah, the broader concern here about corporate control, corporate influence in our government. And I just read Ralph Nader's new book. I don't know if you've seen it. It's called Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. And in that book, Nader says that the left and right can join together to challenge the influence of corporations on our government. Do you see signs of that happening? Do you think that would be a good thing if it did happen?
I think it would be a good thing if it happened, but I think Ralph sees more signs than I see. Now, I already did talk about the antipathy towards Wall Street and big banks, which pops up at really different and certainly left and right points in the political spectrum. So that's certainly there. Whether it goes beyond that is not at all clear to me. And the ultimate problem is that even anti-corporate or libertarian right-wingers still don't see that there's any proper role for the government. So, you know, if anti-corporate means regulation to take one issue that's in the news, require the oil companies that are drilling in North Dakota to process their oil so it's safer, so that when these trains run through communities they don't blow up, the libertarians wouldn't go for that. So I think there are problems with this. You know, Nader also has basically always been one who thought social progress comes from trial lawyers winning anti-corporate suits in court, reflecting, I think, his professional bias, for lack of a better term. And I think, you know, there needs to be a pretty vigilant government regulatory state, which he supports too, but I don't see much of the right going along with that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, we just have 1 minute to go here. Before we leave, I want to ask you, you know, what can we, the people, do, and what are the three most important things you think our listeners can do to help restore a country of the people, by the people, for the people?
Ah, well, they can read my magazine, The American Prospect, and subscribe, www.prospect.org. You can't give too complicated answers in 1 minute intervals. They can certainly urge their legislatures and city governments to look at raising minimum wages and to enact living wage ordinances and things like that. And they can, bolster popular workers' movements where they where they're arising, fast food workers, groups like that. And as best they can raise some of these economic issues to force former Secretary of State Clinton to pay attention to them.
Great. That's all the time we have. Harold Marson, thank you so much for coming on the program.
My pleasure, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com.
window.